This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast,
where this week we are on episode 64. Sorry. Where this week we are on episode 64, where we are covering the strange disappearance of the Sodder children.
Yeah, this case is crazy. And basically what happened is there was a fire where the children were thought to be dead, but in reality, they may be missing.
Yeah. Who knows? Are they alive or dead?
Yes.
So that is the story we are going to be covering today. But before we get into all of that, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So this week, I found a new podcast.
Nice.
And I fell in love with it. It's very similar to, what is Payne Lindsay's podcast where he goes in Radio Rental?
Yeah.
It's kind of similar to Radio Rental where people are telling their crazy stories.
Yeah.
Except it's I Survived. Like, it's made by someone who is a part of I Survived's team, and each episode is a woman telling her story of survival. Usually it's against attacks from men. Mm-hmm. I'm like 10 or 13 episodes in, like somewhere in between there.
Yeah.
And I love I Survived this show, and just being able to listen to it in a podcast is great, and to hear the women themselves talk about it. And there are some crazy things that happen, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds cool. I think Mary Vincent's stories alone is just like the total icing on the cake for mm-hmm. me that like anything is possible in this world, because 100%. That story is just so crazy to me.
Yeah. That are like shot, or like one that like stood out to me for some reason is these women were camping and they went on a hike, and this guy just like hopped out of the woods and tried to take them, and they ended up like using a stick and fighting him off.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. But yeah, that is my binge. It's just nice. It's just called I Survived the Podcast.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. Miss Morgan, what are you binging this week?
This week I am binging the show Selena Gomez, Chef at Home on HBO.
Okay.
And it is basically just Selena Gomez doesn't know how to cook. that's like, she says that. She doesn't know how to cook. She's not very good at it. And she basically, like, while she's quarantining at home, has a bunch of famous chefs video call her, teach her how to make a dish, and they, like, make it together. And it's just, honestly, I wasn't expecting much from it, but it is very heartwarming. You watch Selena Gomez almost maim herself several times. Watching her operate a knife is stressful at times, because she does have like lupus, so she mm-hmm. has trouble with her hands, but she also just like wildly stabs at things with her knife, and I'm like, Selena, I need you to relax.
That's honestly amazing.
Yeah, so it's just like, it's really silly, but it's really funny. And like Roy Choi is one of the chefs on there. So it's just like, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah.
And I love Selena Gomez.
Yeah, it's just like a combination of Selena Gomez and Chef, the show. So
very cool.
Very nice stuff. And it's like, it was all produced over quarantine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so pretty cool. All right, but should we just get on into the case?
I guess so.
All righty, let's do it.
So, George Sodder was the patriarch of the Sodder family. And he was actually born as Giorgio Sadu in Tula, Sardinia, Italy in 1885. And I apologize for pronouncing all of that wrong. In 1908, when he was just 13 years old, he immigrated to America with his older brother. The pair arrived at Ellis Island, but his brother had grown very homesick by the time they reached America, so he turned around and went back to Italy. Giorgio stayed, and then, you know how they change the names at Ellis Island and make it sound more American?
Mm-hmm.
He became George Sauter.
Can I ruin your life for a moment?
Yes.
While I was looking up this case, I looked it up and that's not true.
Really?
Yeah. They actually did not change people's names at Ellis Island because they did not write people's names down when they came into Ellis Island.
I didn't. What? I've always been taught that.
Yeah, or like, I know. Everyone's always. But apparently most people just ended up changing their names to sound more American anyway. Because I always thought that too. And I was just like looking it up and like every single article that came up was like why your fact about Ellis Island is wrong. And I was like, wow. Okay.
My whole life has been a lie.
Yeah. So
I am from Ellis Island. So for the rest of his life, George never really talked about why he left Italy. But some people say it was because he or his family had ties to the mafia back in Italy.
Which, like, I can't tell if that's just Italian racism or if it right? is accurate. You know what I mean?
That is very true. So, George eventually made his way to Pennsylvania and found work on the railroads where he would carry water and other supplies to the workers. After a few years of doing this, he, you know, is now an adult and not a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah.
George found more permanent work as a truck driver in Smither, West Virginia. Eventually, he ended up starting his own trucking company, which became pretty successful. His trucks would haul dirt to construction sites, and it would also haul coal after it had been mined. One day, George walked into a store called The Music Box in Smithers, West Virginia. While there, he met Jenny Caprini.
I think it's Cipriani.
You're right.
So, the couple began dating and eventually got married before settling in Fayetteville, West Virginia. Fayette or Fayette? Not sure. I believe it's Fayette, though.
I'm going to go with Fayette.
Fayetteville was a small town with a large Italian immigrant community. The couple lived in a two-story timber-framed house that was just 2 miles outside of town, and they had their first of 10 children in 1923.
That is a lot of children.
Yeah, like it's common because it's the 20s, but still, just too many, you know? I can barely remember my single cat's name. Like, I just don't understand how people keep track of 10 children. It's right. just baffling to me. So George's trucking business was very successful. And one of the city officials said that the Sauters were one of the most respected middle class families around. Like, they were very well respected in town because of his business. But George also had very strong opinions about many topics, including business, current events, and politics. His strong opinions would sometimes put people off to him, especially his strong opposition to the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, who founded and led the National Fascist Party. And this led to a lot of arguments with other people in the local Italian community. And even though he was outspoken about a lot of these things, again, he never really talked about his childhood and why he came to America. He was just very outspoken about Mussolini. The last of the 10 children that George and Jenny would have, a girl named Sylvia, was born in 1943. By this time, their second oldest son, Joe, was across seas in the military serving in World War II. Around a year later, in April 1945, Benito Mussolini was deposed and executed. Where people in Fayetteville were upset about this, George celebrated and told others he believed that it should have been done years ago, which left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths. Obviously, this is the 40s. But, like, I've always been taught that Mussolini's a terrible, terrible guy.
Right.
And he's, like, he started the fascist party. So, but, I feel like...
I mean, I guess, you know...
I would like to know the cultural relevance that would, like, make other people also like him, you know? I think I would just need to study that more because I find it interesting.
Then, some strange things started happening to the Sodders. In October of 1945, a life insurance salesman came to the house wanting to sell George some life insurance. That's what a life insurance salesman does.
This, okay, last week you made a very strange Office reference, so this week I'm going to.
Okay.
This whole thing reminds me of, like, the time Michael thinks that guy is, like, part of the Italian mafia while trying to sell him life insurance. And that's what this kind of feels like, where they're like, he was selling me life insurance, but I'm pretty sure he was going to kill me because he was part of the mafia.
I mean, I could be 100% wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm like, now I'm convinced that that episode of The Office was based off of this.
It
like,
could have been.
There's no way.
It very well could have been. Yeah, that's very true.
Okay. So this guy wanted to sell George some life insurance.
Yes.
And George was like, nah, man, I'm good. So he said no and sent the salesman on his way. But as this man was leaving the house, he just started to get angry for no reason and yelled, your goddamn house is going up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed. You're going to be paid for the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that part's weird. Like, why'd you bring up Mussolini?
Why'd you bring up his children?
Yeah.
And since George had gotten into many, many heated debates and arguments about his disdain for Mussolini, he didn't take what this man said seriously.
Yeah.
And shortly after, probably a few weeks later, another man showed up at the Sodder residence. And this time, he was looking for work and asked George if he needed any help with the trucking company. After George told him that he couldn't take on any more staff at the moment, the man, you know, accepted this and left, but walked out of the house and looked at the fuse box for a second, and then just warned George, saying that the fuse box would cause a fire someday. And George thought this was bizarre, as he had recently had an electric stove installed in the house, and when he got this stove installed, he had all of the wiring in the house redone, and all of the work passed the inspections, deeming it safe.
Yeah.
So, knowing that his wiring was safe, George brushed off this statement. In December of 1945, during the weeks leading up to Christmas, some of the older Sodder children noticed a man parked along U.S. Highway 21, which was, like, right by their house.
Mm-hmm.
And they noticed him a few times, and they could clearly see that he was watching the younger children as they walked home from school.
Yeah, which is not what you want ever.
No. Creepo.
On Christmas Eve, 1945, the Sodders were celebrating and were going to open a few presents. You know, the night before Christmas, you gotta do the classic open a gift for the whole family type thing. Yeah. One of their sons was away in the army at the time, but George and the two oldest boys, John, who was 23, and George Jr., 16, had worked all day, and they were exhausted, so they went upstairs to go to bed early. The eldest daughter, Marion, had been working at a dime store in downtown Fayetteville and returned home shortly before bedtime, bringing home some presents for the younger children. The children were so excited that they asked their mother if they could stay up past their bedtime to play with the toys, and Marion agreed to watch them while they played, like a very nice older sister.
Oh, yeah. I don't have younger siblings, but I wouldn't have done
that. Whenever my nieces and nephews are like, do you want to play? I'm like, maybe later. And later never comes.
I'm having an adult conversation. I need you to walk away.
So Jenny agreed to this, but said only if the two boys that were awake, Maurice, who was 14, and Louis, who is 9. It's Louis, isn't it? I feel like it's
Italian, it's Louis.
Yeah. And Louis, 9, fed the chickens and brought the cows in before they went to bed. Jenny went to bed at around 10 p.m., taking the youngest, Sylvia, who at this time was 2 years old, to bed with her, as she slept in the room with her parents, like in a crib next to the bed. The phone rang, waking Jenny up at 12:30 a.m. The phone was in another room in George's office, so Jenny rushed out of bed to answer it. When she picked up the phone, a woman's voice, who Jenny didn't recognize, was on the other end and asked for a person that Jenny had never heard of. Jenny could hear the sounds of glasses clinking and laughter in the background. When she told the caller that she had the wrong number, the woman just started laughing weirdly, so Jenny hung up the phone.
Yeah.
Realistically, she was probably just drunk, you
oh,
know?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
It was like, I'm picturing that conversation now ending in that type of laugh, and it's the worst. When she was returning to bed, Jenny noticed that the lights were still on in the living room, so she went to check it out. You can't leave lights on, man.
Especially in the 40s.
If you're a parent and you see a light on, it's your duty to go turn it off. She saw Marion sleeping on the couch, but none of the other children, Maurice, Louis, Martha, Jenny, and Betty, were in the living room. So she assumed they had just gone upstairs to bed. The windows to the curtains, nope, the curtains on the windows were left open and the door was unlocked, which Jenny thought was strange because usually the children would take care of those things before bed. But she just did it anyway. She closed the curtains, locked the door, and turned off the lights, and then returned to bed. Shortly after, at around 1 a.m., Jenny woke up again, this time to a loud sound. She described it as sounding like something hitting the roof and then rolling off. After hearing this, she laid in bed for a few minutes, listening, and then when she didn't hear any other sounds, fell back asleep.
So, Jenny was woken up again about a half hour later, but this time to the smell of smoke. She got up to look around and saw that the room George used for his office was on fire around the telephone. She went to wake George and to get the other children. The parents, Marion, Sylvia, and the two older boys, John and George Jr., were the first to escape the house. And the boys ran from their upstairs bedroom and singed their hair on their way out.
Yeah.
And also, Jenny and George's bedroom were downstairs. So the people that escaped the house initially, or altogether, mm-hmm. were Jenny, George, who were downstairs, with Sylvia and Marion, who were downstairs, and John and George, who ran down from upstairs. They were frantically yelling for the other children, but got no response. And at this point, the stairway itself leading to the children was on fire. Marion tried calling the fire department, but the phone wasn't working, so she had to run to the neighbors to do so. When she got there, she couldn't get an operator response, so the neighbor literally drove into town to track down Fire Chief F.J. Morris, and he initiated their version of a fire alarm, which was a phone tree.
Yeah.
And a phone tree is like where one firefighter calls another and so on and so forth.
We used phone trees a lot in church because we weren't allowed to take our cell phones to camp with us. So our parents had a phone tree to let them know we made it safe when we arrived at camp.
I hate that. I also hate that you couldn't have your cell phones at camp. Like,
it was Christian camp, Sarah. You had to get closer to God without your cell phone.
Okay. So, this also is the weirdest thing ever.
Yeah.
The fire chief couldn't drive the fire truck? Like, I feel like that's the one thing you have to do to become fire chief.
Yeah, but he couldn't do it.
No. So, he had to get a hold of someone who could. And also, it was hard to get a hold of someone as it was officially now Christmas.
Right.
There was also a neighbor who saw the blaze and tried calling the fire department and a nearby tavern, but also couldn't get a hold of an operator. Mm-hmm. George was determined to get his children out, so he climbed the house barefoot and broke open an attic window, cutting his arm pretty badly in the process. When he broke open the window, he could basically only see smoke and fire spreading throughout all the rooms in his home.
Yeah.
He raced back, looking for his ladder that he always kept propped up against the house, but for some reason it was missing. Then George and his sons tried to pull both of the trucks to the side of the house so he could climb on top of them, but Despite them working perfectly fine the day before, they wouldn't start. George then tried one last desperate attempt to simply throw water on the flames from some water barrels, but they were frozen solid because this is West Virginia on Christmas.
Yeah.
So the family could do nothing but watch their home go up in flames and assume the five other children had perished.
Yeah.
Which would just be so sad to just sit there and not be able to do anything.
Yeah, that would be awful. The fire department was only about 2.5 miles away from the home, but they didn't arrive until 8 a.m. And by that time, the house had basically been reduced to ash.
Like, the fire started at 1 a.m. That is 7 hours for the fire department to get there. I am appalled.
Yeah. Like, I get it. It's the 40s, my guy. But, like, I don't know. It seems like that's a long stretch of time to make it to a fire.
I'm just still pissed at the fire chief.
Yeah. Like, learn how to drive your own fire truck. Right? A search began in the homes to find the remains of the five other children. And by 10 a.m., just 2 hours later, Morris, the fire chief, moron, more like it, ha, 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 ha. I'm really sorry.
I'm honestly surprised you did that with a straight face and didn't crack up in between.
Honestly, this is how dead inside I am, that I can just look at you and make that noise and not feel anything.
I love it.
All right. So the fire chief, after 2 hours, came back and said he couldn't find any bones. He believed that all of the children had died in the fire and that it had simply been hot enough to just completely burn their bodies, including their bones. According to another account, a few bone fragments and internal organs were found, but the chief just chose not to tell the family because he didn't want to upset them.
Right.
So either way, not great. Modern professionals note that if they were truly only looking for 2 hours, that this is not a very thorough search, and you wouldn't be able to determine if the children had died that quickly.
Because this was a house with a basement, a first floor, a second floor, and an attic.
Yeah, it doesn't take 2 hours to look through.
Right?
Yeah. Morris told George to leave the site alone so they could conduct a more thorough search or an investigation. But after just 4 days, George, consumed by grief probably, bulldozed over the site with dirt with the intention of converting it into a memorial garden, which Jenny would tend to for the rest of her life. An inquest was held, and the fire was determined to be caused by faulty wiring. One of the jurors involved in this decision was the man who had recently threatened George that his house would be burned down, which is a weird coinkydink. The coroner's office issued 5 death certificates on December 30th, and the cause of death was listed as fire or suffocation.
They just took their pick.
Yeah, because they weren't sure. A funeral was held on January 2nd, 1946, for the children. And George and Jenny were so heartbroken that they didn't attend the funeral, but the other surviving children did. And the local newspaper also didn't help that, like, all of these weird things were going on, because they published an article saying that the bodies of all 5 children were found, only to revise their article the next day saying that only part of one body was found.
Soon after, the family began to try to rebuild their lives, planting flowers in their new garden, and while they did so, they also began questioning the official findings surrounding the fire. Besides all of the weird incidents that happened to the family before, there were also weird things surrounding the fire.
Yeah.
The cause of the fire was deemed to be an electrical issue, but the family's Christmas lights remained on throughout the fire's early stages when the power should have been out.
Yeah.
The family originally thought that the phones weren't working in the home because the wires had been burned, but a telephone technician came out and determined that the line had actually been cut. In order to cut this line, someone would have had to climb up a 14-foot pole and then reach top. And then at the top, reach 2 feet away to reach the wire.
Yeah, like they would basically have to like be 14 feet in the air dangling over to cut the wire, yeah. Essentially.
This also would have had to have been done after 12:30 a.m., but before 1 a.m., because at 12:30 a.m., Jenny received a phone call from that strange woman, and yeah. At 1 a.m. is when she discovered the fire.
Right.
Apparently, some people had also spotted a man leaving the home, and he was arrested for the crime of cutting the wire, but there is no record of the suspect existing.
Nowadays, yeah.
Another witness came forward saying that he saw a man at the scene of the fire stealing a box and tackle, which is used for removing car engines. And this could have been why the trucks didn't start. And this also could have been the same man who cut the wire. The family also came across a local bus driver who said that he saw what he could only describe as fireballs being thrown in the sky by the Sodders' residence.
Yeah.
So another strange thing that happened is that they found the missing ladder that is always propped up against the house, and it was actually thrown to the bottom of an embankment 75 feet away from the home.
Yeah.
Which is like, it wouldn't have just ended up there.
Yeah, it's not like there was a massive wind that blew it over there, like, to our knowledge, you know?
Right?
It,
like, there was... it's far away.
Yeah. So, Jenny personally didn't believe that there would be no remains left behind of her children, as there were still many household appliances left behind in the fire. So Jenny started conducting experiments of her own by burning small piles of animal bones to see if they would be completely burned, and none ever were.
And this sounds a little morbid, but yeah. It was of like the chickens that they use for dinner and stuff like that. It wasn't like they were just killing random animals.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound great, but it's just like, it's because there's so many things to this story, because it's like the 40s, mm-hmm. and Jenny just wears black the rest of her life. And it's, so I'm just like picturing this woman all dressed in black, like staring at a pile of animal bones. And it's just like so very witchy. Yeah. Yeah. So she then called a local crematorium that said human bones remain even after bodies are burned at 2000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's 1090 degrees Celsius.
Oh, snap.
For 2 hours, which was considered to be far longer and hotter than the house fire could have been. Because according to Jenny, the house was completely turned to ash within 45 minutes. Because these houses are built of wood instead of, like, steel and shit.
Yeah.
Now. I don't know what they make homes out of.
It depends on your house.
Concrete.
I'm pretty sure my apartment's just made out of plastic, but... yeah.
That's because it's an apartment, you know? Just gotta fucking throw up some...
yep. It's plastic walls. And drywall.
She also compared their fire to a newspaper article of a fire in a house around the same time. And the full skeletons of all 7 people who died in that fire were recovered.
Like, it's not like some of the bones were recovered. It was their full skeletons.
Yeah, of all 7 people.
Correct.
The trucks not starting was something that the family had thought was strange as well, because they'd been working previously. But there had really been no evidence that the cars should not be working. So people believe that in their panic, the men actually just flooded the engines of their vehicles, like nothing was taken from them. But because it's so long ago, it's hard to say if an investigation was actually done to see if things were taken from their vehicles.
Exactly.
The family also then went back to the site of the home after the snow had melted. And while they were there, they discovered a hard rubber object in the yard. George believed it was a napalm or pineapple bomb that was found, and Jenny believed that this was the thud she heard on the roof of the house before the fire. Would make sense, and people said they saw balls of fire getting thrown at the house. And the strange phone call was also thought to be part of the fire, But the woman who called was supposedly tracked down, and she admitted that she had just called the wrong number. So that one was kind of just a weird coinkydink, supposedly. And a woman who was familiar with the Sodders came forward saying that she saw five children getting into a car in front of the Sodders' residence on the night of the fire.
So, at this point, after all of these clues, the family didn't think that the children had actually perished in the fire, and instead they had been kidnapped. This belief was strengthened further when there were reported sightings of the missing children. One woman said that she saw the missing children peering out of a passing car while the fire was in progress. Another woman, who was working at a tourist shop between Fayetteville and Charleston, about 50 miles away, said that she also saw the missing children the morning after the fire. She told police that she served them breakfast and there was a car with a Florida license plate in the parking lot. At a hotel in Charleston, a woman said she saw four of the five children about a week after the fire, and that they were accompanied by two women and two men that looked to be Italian. When they checked into the hotel, it was around midnight, and they stayed in a large room with several beds. The woman said that she tried to talk to the children, but one of the men got really hostile towards her and refused to let her talk to them, and the whole party left early the next morning. The family was growing disappointed, so in 1947, George and Jenny sent a letter about the case to the FBI.
Yeah.
And director J. Edgar Hoover sent them back a reply saying, "Although I would like to be of service, the matter related appears to be of local character and does not come within the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau." He said he would help if he could get permission from the local authorities, but the Fayetteville police declined the help.
And when the police wouldn't help, the family hired a PI named C.C. Tinsley. He discovered that the insurance salesman who had come to the home and had been threatening George was a member of the coroner's jury that deemed the fire to be an accident.
Yeah, because there was, like, I guess in the 40s, they had juries that, like, went through the evidence and mm-hmm. stuff and deemed the fire to be
yeah.
accidental. And I was like, I feel like that's weird because I feel like that would just be, like, the fire chief's thing and not a actual jury, but
yeah, you would think, because I think that's what it is now, is like the fire department themselves mm-hmm. investigate that, right?
Yeah.
So the investigator was also told a story from a local minister about Fire Chief Morris, and he said that even though Morris said no remains were found, he said that he had found a heart at the scene but then buried it when he found it. So the private investigator's like, yo, what the fuck?
Yeah, like, how is there a heart but no yeah. bones? What the fuck?
And Tinsley was able to get Morris to tell him where he buried this said heart, but it turns out that it was a beef liver. Morris had buried remains around the, like, site, hoping that it would make the family stop the investigation, which is very sus if you ask me.
It really is.
Over the next few years, tips would continue to trickle in that the children were still alive. George saw a photo of a child in New York and was convinced it was his daughter, Betty. He went all the way there to search for the child, but the girl's parents would not allow them to speak to him. And it was eventually determined that this was not Betty. In 1949, the Sodders decided they were going to do a new search at the fire scene and brought in a pathologist to do so. An excavation was done, and it uncovered several small objects like damaged coins, a partly burned dictionary, and several shards of vertebrae. The pathologist, Oscar Hunter, sent the bones to the Smithsonian Institute, which issued a report, and this report said that the human bones consist of four lumbar vertebrae belonging to one individual. Since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. The top limit of age should be about 22, since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused. On this basis, the bones show greater skeletal maturation than one would expect for a 14-year-old boy, which was the oldest missing Sauter child. It is, however, possible, although not probable, for a boy 14 and a half years old to show 16 to 17-year-old maturation. So, it's likely not their bones.
Like, it's science.
Yeah. The thing that is super weird about the vertebra is that it doesn't show any evidence of being exposed to fire, and there was no evidence of any other bones at the scene, just these specific vertebra.
Right? And, you know, vertebrae are a small bone.
Yeah.
And, like, that would not withstand a fire that, like, a femur would.
Yeah.
Wouldn't.
And it was believed that these bones were actually just mixed into the dirt that George had used to fill in the basement and weren't the bones of the Sauter children at all. It was just, like, a coincidental, accidental thing that, like, it got mixed in.
Which is, I mean, weird, but also the 40s.
Yeah. Also, yeah. So, the Smithsonian reports led to two hearings at the Capitol in Charleston, where the governor and state police superintendent told the Sauters their search was hopeless and the case was closed on the local level. The FBI actually decided that it had jurisdiction on the case as a possible interstate kidnapping, but after following fruitless leads for 2 years, dropped the case.
So, George and Jenny took matters into their own hands.
Again.
Right? And erected a billboard along Route 16. They also passed out flyers that offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to their children, which this amount was soon doubled to $10,000. A letter then came in saying that the oldest daughter, Martha, was living in a convent in St. Louis. Another tip came in from Texas, where someone at a bar overheard a conversation with incriminating statements between two people about a Christmas fire in West Virginia. Another person in Florida said that the children were staying with a distant relative of Jenny, and the relative's own children actually looked like the missing Sauter children, and George went there and wasn't satisfied until this relative gave actual proof that they were his children.
Yeah.
In 1967, a woman wrote to the family saying that she was with a man who revealed that he was Louis Sauter after having too much to drink. She believed that Louis and Maurice were living somewhere in Texas. George and his son-in-law, Grover Paxton, went to Houston to check it out. And the Houston police helped them to identify the two men this woman were talking about, but they both denied being the missing children. Grover Paxton said that for the rest of George's life, he had doubts about this denial.
Interesting.
And George would actually travel to each lead that they got to investigate it, but he never came home with any more answers.
Yeah.
20 years after the fire, in 1968, Jenny received a letter that was addressed only to her. It was postmarked in Kentucky, but there was no return address. There was a picture of a man in his mid-20s inside, and on the backside it had a cryptic handwritten note that said, "Louis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, little boys, A90132 or 35. Her and George thought that the similarities between this man and their son Louis were obvious. The dark curly hair, dark brown eyes, a straight strong nose, and the upward tilt of the left eyebrow. So, they hired another private investigator and sent him to Kentucky, but the private investigator disappeared, taking the Sauter's money with him.
Yeah.
So, this is probably a scam. The couple didn't publish the letter in case it would cause harm to their son, so they just put the updated image on their billboard, and they also printed out this picture and hung it over their fireplace.
Yeah. The thing that's really weird about that note to me is, like, just all of the numbers on the back, because it's not, like, a date or anything, which is common to, like, date things, but the A in front of it is just weird.
It really is. And also, there was no other brother named Frankie or anything like that.
Yeah, it's just very strange. In an interview with the Charleston Gazette Mail the next year, George said, "Time is running out for us, but we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them." He also said that the lack of information was like hitting a rock wall. We can't go any further. Unfortunately, he passed away a year later in 1968. Jenny put a fence around her property and began adding rooms to her home. And since the funeral, like I mentioned earlier, Jenny exclusively wore black to show she was in mourning and continued to do so until she passed away in 1989. So she wore black for like 40 years, which is incredible.
She was the goth queen.
Yeah. After she passed, her children took down the billboard but continued the investigation, coming up with some theories of their own. So, and here are some of those theories. The local mafia had tried to recruit their father, and he declined, so they then tried to extort money from him, but he refused. The children were kidnapped by someone they knew who offered to take them to a safe place away from the fire, and then they've been gone since then. And some of them believed that the children were taken to Italy by the Sicilian mafia, but they never received any communication from the mafia asking for money in the return of the children. And they were known for using kidnapping to extort money from victims' families at this time. They also thought that if the children were alive and knew that the other members of their family had survived that night, that they didn't reach out in order to keep their families out of harm's way. Sylvia, who is now 76, the youngest and last surviving as of 2019 in August. That's the last I could find. She doesn't believe that her siblings died in the fire that night. She still looks into things about the case when time allows and says that even though she was only two the night of the fire, she will never forget the horror she felt that night. She said that she was the last to leave home and would stay up late with her parents discussing what could have happened. She said, "I experienced their grief for a long time." Sylvia's daughter was also interviewed in 2006 and said about her mother, "She promised my grandparents she wouldn't let the story die, that she would do everything she could."
And that's the story of everything we know about the Sodders.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, do you have an opinion on what you think happened?
I honestly have no fucking idea. Like, I don't think they died in the fire that night simply because I think their bones would have been there.
Yeah.
But I also think it's insane to think that five children lived that long after the fire and like never saw their parents again. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Unless they were like sold or something like that, like something happened to them. I don't know. It feels weird to think that they just like, all five of them were living somewhere and just like never talk to their family again, you know?
And so like, I think it's obviously strange that it's the specific five children that stayed up late are the ones that are gone. And then that Marion was still downstairs. So like, did she not see anything? Like, I kind of thought like maybe she was drugged or she was hit on the head, didn't remember.
Right.
Or something like that. Or another theory I actually saw while I was researching on, I think it was True Crime Chronicles. They asked, what if all five children went outside to go like feed the children and do the cows and get ready for bed? Mm-hmm. So that way it got done quicker. And when they were outside away from Marion, they were taken. So that way like didn't hear or see what was happening.
Right.
And then they were gone. And that would have explained like,
yeah,
the door being unlocked and everything. And also, we never knew if the chickens and cows were taken care of that night or anything like that.
Yeah, it's super fucking weird.
I
have no idea. I have no idea what happened, why it happened. But it's one of those cases that, like, I think about a lot.
And, like, because I definitely don't think that they died in the fire. There would have been proof.
Yeah, I think that just because there were so many like appliances and things left behind that it just seems very unlikely. Granted, like, if it's all going down on each other, like the house is collapsing, mm-hmm. You could probably make an argument that like it was burning at a higher heat in that specific area. But bones are very hard to burn. So I think it's wild that not a single bone was found from any of the kids.
And if the kids, where they slept in their room, was on the upper level of the house, yeah. Their bodies or bones would have been on the top level of the rubble.
Yeah.
So they would have been found easier than having to dig through to the bottom.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I didn't think of that. Yeah, this is a weird case, and you can go down like a Reddit rabbit hole for days and days and days, I'm sure.
Because there was also something else where it said that John, in his initial statement, mm-hmm. had said that he went upstairs to grab his siblings, but then in his second statement, he said that he couldn't because the staircase was on fire, so they're like, which one is it? And he's like, the first statement I told you, I was frantic because, my house burned down. Yeah, right?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'm pretty sure there's a theory that, like, the older brothers did it, too.
Oh, yeah?
Because they were, like, in the upper part of the stairs, like, in the upper mm-hmm. part of the house with the kids, and then they were the only ones who were able to get free singeing their hair, you know? But I don't know, because I think John is the like only sibling who doesn't talk about the case, right? There's one sibling who like refuses to discuss the case now because they don't like hearing about it.
Mm-hmm. But it's also weird that like Jenny being downstairs was the only one who heard the bang and rolling on the roof when like the older kids would have been upstairs and would have heard it.
Yeah, like, maybe they were just teenagers and they sleep really heavy.
That's true.
I don't know. It's one of those cases you could ask like a million what ifs.
Exactly.
Yeah. But we hope that you guys enjoyed this. We haven't done a Unsolved in a little bit, so it was fun
to get away from
Richard Ramirez.
Yeah, right. And tell us your theories, because I'm interested.
For sure. Tell us your theories on Instagram, Twitter, or when you leave us a 5-star review.
You could also tell them when you go to our website, which is crimebinge.com, and you can leave a submission telling us your opinion. Or telling us your listener stories about true crime, paranormal, whatever the hell creepy thing you want to tell us about.
Yeah, we would love to hear those stories from you guys. And if you want to interact with us more, you can hit us up on Crime Binge on Twitter, Crime Binge Podcast on Instagram, and on Facebook, right?
Exactly.
Yes. Damn, I got it right for once in my life. But we hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and
keep on binging.
Bye.
See y'all.